session in our second year of Murray Edwards' Capitalism on the Edge series. As I think many of you here will know, this series has taken a critical look at the underpinnings of the capitalist economy. The financial crisis of 2008 caused a global recession where banks failed, credit disappeared, government intervention became essential, and the magnitude of public debt instigated draconian austerity measures. This crisis and the responses to it put capitalism in the spotlight, with many wondering if the principles on which we wanted to run an economy were in fact embedded in the system, when it so apparently resulted in instability, gross inequality, and little, if no, regulation the actions of some of its key players. This Capitalism on the Edge series has questioned the system from various perspectives. Whether large business can be a force for good in society, what is the purpose of finance, how capitalism drives global and intergenerational inequalities, and the role of trade unions in trying to reduce income inequalities, and most recently, whether capitalism can be ethical. Tonight, I'm very pleased to introduce and welcome our speakers who are going to continue this debate, Professor Kate Pickett and Professor Danny Dorling. Kate Pickett is Professor of Epidemiology at the University of York. She's a co-founder and trustee of the Equality Trust and co-author with Richard Wilkinson of The Spirit Level, a prize-winning book which highlights the problems caused by the unequal distribution of incomes, in particular the impact on a range of health and social issues and the effect on children's well-being and life chances. She's also been part of a group, including economists Joseph Stiglitz and J.K. Galbraith, who are calling for change and outlining how we might move from the crisis to a more egalitarian society. Danny Dorling is Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. His work concerns issues of housing, health, employment, education, wealth and poverty. Among his many books are Inequality and the 1%, which shows the rise in inequality since the 2008 crisis, Injustice, Why Social Inequality Still Persists, and Bankrupt Britain, An Atlas of Social Change. Tonight, Kate and Danny will be talking about capitalism and inequality, Brexit versus really taking back control. Let's give them a warm welcome, please.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Good evening. Thank you all for coming. Danny and I had a look at the technology earlier. I thought we'd figure it out. No.
Not sure I know.
Yeah.
Yes. You're on for this slide, okay?
Thank you. When I first started working with Richard Wilkinson, looking at the impact of inequality on health and social problems, it was sort of the mid-2000s, early to mid-2000s. And one day I went up to Scotland to a conference to present some of our research. And afterwards, a member of the Scottish Parliament, a Labour member of the Scottish Parliament, came up to me and he said, how much he appreciated the work and how important he thought it was. And I naively said to him, great, what are you going to do about it? And he backed away and said, oh, nothing. We're not allowed to talk about inequality in New Labour. So they couldn't even sort of have a public discussion or any kind of conversation about the impact of inequality. And the reason I wanted to put these quotes up is to show how much that has changed. So these are all from 2013, and in that year we have Barack Obama calling inequality the defining challenge of our time. We have the Pope calling it the root of social ills. And Christine Lagarde, director of the International Monetary Fund, talking about how the economics profession has ignored inequality for too long, and that we now understand the impact of inequality on a whole range of issues, and Ban Ki-moon, UN Secretary General as well. So what a change, really, to go from a situation where political parties couldn't discuss inequality, however progressive they were, to a situation where we've got lots of leaders across the world really trying to open up that debate and recognising the impact of inequality. And it's not just politicians. Oxfam, traditionally focused on poverty, now have a campaign, I believe it's a 10-year campaign running, to reduce inequality. And they go to Davos, the World Economic Forum every year, bringing this kind of statistic that the 85 richest people own the same wealth as the bottom 3.5 billion in the world. That number is now 83, I think. So the situation isn't getting better. But NGOs focused on inequality. When we established the Equality Trust, there were no organisations in Britain campaigning against inequality. There are now several. We have the High Pay Centre, the Resolution Foundation, as well as the Equality Trust, and inequality activities going on, quite a lot of other think tanks as well. So the political discourse has shifted, and civic society is starting to discuss these issues more. And the public have opinions and attitudes about inequality that would support a reduction. This chart comes from research that was done at Harvard Business School. And they asked 5,000 Americans how they thought wealth was distributed in the United States. And what they would like it to be. So the bottom is what they would like it to be, and they would really like income to be reasonably, equitably distributed. That's actually what they were looking at, was the Swedish distribution, although they weren't told that. What they think it actually is the middle line, and then what it actually is the top. So there's a huge discrepancy between what Americans would like their income distribution to look like and what it actually is. And the interesting thing is that 92% of people picked that bottom, more equitable distribution, and it didn't matter whether they were Republican or Democrat, young or old, men or women, African American, Hispanic or white. So those factors didn't play into it. And if we look at the British Social Attitudes Survey, year after year after year, about 80% of us in Britain think that inequalities are too great and would like the government to do something about them. And the reasons we need to do something about inequality just get ever more compelling. This slide is from our book, The Spirit Level, and in it we created an index of health and social problems and related it to inequality in rich, developed countries. And we were looking really at sort of three kinds of issues. One were health issues, so we know that in more unequal societies, people have shorter life expectancy, higher infant mortality rates, they're more likely to be obese, they're more likely to have mental illnesses, there's more drug and alcohol addiction. In developing and emerging economies, there's a strong link between income inequality and HIV/AIDS prevalence as well. So a whole raft of health problems get worse in more unequal societies. But then there's a set of issues that are really around social relationships, how we relate to one another. So in more unequal societies, fewer people trust each other. There's more violence. There's lower social capital. The position of women is not so good. And then there's a whole set of problems that were really around what we could call children's life chances. So child well-being is lower in more unequal societies. More young women have babies as teenagers, more kids drop out of school, their educational attainment is lower. So that's strong evidence of a whole raft of health and social problems linked to greater inequality. And the really interesting thing is that the impact is large. Some of these problems are 10, 12, 16 times higher in more unequal countries compared to the more equal ones. but also that the effect goes all the way up society. So it isn't just the poor who are affected by inequality, although they are the worst affected, but it's like our colleagues at Harvard describing inequality as a social pollutant. It's something that affects the whole society. So when inequality increases, the social distances between us increase, and we are all subject to the impact of that greater inequality. Now, we published this chart in 2009, and the research evidence hasn't stood still. There's been a lot of new research really strengthening the evidence. Some of the most important has been looking at things like changes in inequality over time and changes in outcomes. This is one we produced in 2015 that's looking at changes in inequality over a decade and changes in child well-being in rich countries. And the countries that became more unequal saw declines in child well-being, and the countries that became a little bit more equal over that decade saw their child well-being scores improve. Sweden is a perfect example here. So Sweden has the fastest growing inequality in the OECD and is seeing a decline in its educational attainment, a decline in its child well-being, and various other problems. But we've had studies now looking at changes in inequality in US states and finding that those with the least increases in inequality saw the best change in life expectancy. And we've had research that looks to see how long does it take, and it seems to take about 7 years for changes in inequality to have an impact on death rates, for example. So we're starting to get more of this time series evidence and longitudinal evidence, which means that we feel surer and surer that this is a causal relationship, that it is inequality causing these problems and not just a correlation, not just an association. But perhaps the area that's grown most has been research on the psychological impact, the psychosocial impact of inequality. We hypothesized that an underpinning link between inequality and all of the health and social problems that we see was that people become more anxious about their social position in more unequal societies, that inequality makes social status more salient, and so people need to be more aware of it, and they worry about it more. And now that's actually been shown to be true. So these data come from European countries, EU countries, and the top line are countries with high levels of inequality, and the bottom line, countries with low levels of inequality. And what we're looking at are a measure of status anxiety across the income distribution. So you can see that there's more status anxiety on the, not very good at left and right, I think, left. The poorest, among the poorest of the population, but that inequality effect goes all the way up to the richest tenth of the population. So more anxiety among the whole population. And really, I think this results in three kinds of responses to this anxiety. There's sort of different ways you can cope. And the first is that people withdraw or go under, and that's why we see more depression, more anxiety. But another way is to sort of big yourself up and try and sort of tough it out and pretend you're okay. So we see a rise in narcissism in the US consistent with the rise in inequality. Some of you might guess where I'm going. But narcissism, you know, it's you can take the narcissism personality inventory on the internet if you like. You should have a go. It's quite illuminating. 20 sets of questions. One of them is, do you think the world would be a better place if you were in charge? So I failed that one. Because there's always a couple of things one might do. But, you know, narcissism actually is hugely problematic for the people who suffer from it, for their families, their friends, their colleagues, etc. So a rise in narcissism is self-enhancement, saying that we're better than average. 96% of Americans think they are better drivers than average. 66% in Sweden, still too high, but you can see the difference. And a 2011 study found a strong relationship between self-enhancement and inequality. So you can go under, or you can try to sort of tough it out and beat yourself up. Or, of course, you can seek solace in things like shopping, drugs, gambling, alcohol, all of the ways in which one might try to comfort oneself for living in a state of greater anxiety. So across the sort of psychological board, and all of these health and social problems, there seems to be huge problems created by inequality and no benefits. But if you talk to some people about tackling inequality, they'll say we need some. You know, we need a bit of inequality because it's that that drives aspirations, it's that that drives creativity, it's that that creates the wealth which was supposed to trickle down but didn't. That people should be rewarded for their ability to make money, etc. So they think there are compelling reasons to tolerate some inequality. They're wrong on every single count. There is less creativity in more unequal societies, and we can see that because they grant fewer patents per capita. Children's life chances, as I mentioned, are worse in more unequal societies, so we're not creating aspirations, or if we are, we're certainly not allowing them to be met. And when we pay people ridiculously large salaries, they actually don't do any better than when we don't. In fact, we do worse. This is quite a recent graph, and it's comparing performance of companies. Those on the red line are where the CEO gets more than the median CEO salary, and the top line are the ones where they get less. And so the ones where they're being paid more are less productive. So there seem to be absolutely no redeeming features whatsoever of allowing inequality to grow. It damages business. We have economists now, like Joe Stiglitz and others, talking about how inequality creates cycles of boom and bust. We know it gets in the way of poverty reduction. And by increasing the consumerism that's driven by status anxiety, we know it's bad for the environment as well. So no redeeming features. Now, I said world leaders are talking about inequality. Our government isn't really. I was quite excited when Theresa May stood on the steps of Downing Street and said she might let some employee representatives sit on company boards. A step in the right direction. Now it's not going to happen. And so in our country, with our high toxic levels of inequality, we're not hearing at national level the rhetoric that we're hearing at international level, and we're not seeing policies designed to reduce inequality, far from it, quite the opposite. But we do have a framework now for the world, and we may have voted to leave the European Union, but we're still a member of the United Nations. And all 193 countries in the UN signed up to the Sustainable Development Goals for 2030. And goal 10 is reduced inequalities within and between countries. So we're supposed to achieve that by 2030. There are 168 targets that sit underneath these 17 goals. And they apply just as much to the UK and the USA and other rich developed countries as they do to the developing countries and emerging economies which were targeted by their predecessors, the Millennium Development Goals. So it's up to us now to hold our country, our government, to account for achieving the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And I would argue that number 10 might be a central one for achieving many of the others. I mentioned narcissism and the US. This graph came out in The Economist, was it last week, Danny? And it's showing that counties in the US with more health problems were more likely to swing towards Trump. And there are other studies showing that political polarization increases with inequality. So whether it's Brexit, or whether it's Trump, or whether it's the rise of Marine Le Pen in France, political polarization is another consequence of inequality, and perhaps the most dangerous. I think Danny's going to talk more about Brexit, but I will finish up now by just saying that it troubles me that we have so much evidence, but we're not seeing change. We're not seeing policy change, political action. That really worries me. Because I'm an epidemiologist and work in public health, I know how strong our evidence base is on what causes inequalities in health. We've known for 30, 40 years what the social determinants of health are, what the root causes of health inequalities are, and we haven't managed to change them at all. In fact, they're growing. So despite a strong UK tradition of research in that area, we haven't actually managed to change inequalities in health on the ground. And I worry because sometimes even when we get evidence of what works and what doesn't, we just carry on being idiots and persisting in our errors and continuing to make the same mistakes. I think it's about a month ago that we learned that the Troubled Families Scheme has had no impact in Britain. Is it going to stop? No. I worked on a trial of the Family Nurse Partnership designed to improve the health and well-being of pregnant teenagers and their babies. It didn't work. Are we going to stop doing it? No. So what does it take for us to really bring our scientific research into the public arena and then make change happen? I don't know all the answers to that, although I have some ideas and suggestions, but I think we can talk about those in the Q&A session. Okay, I'm going to hand over to Danny now, so thank you very much.
Although it took me some time to realise I was a very bad driver, because I grew up in Britain where you learn to say how good you are. And because I realised I was an awful driver, quite a few years ago I gave up having a car, and I now cycle and use public transport every day. That is great news for me, because it reduces the chance of me being in a crash. It's even better news for you, for obvious reasons. And if you just want a very small example of why inequality is a problem, obviously in more unequal countries you have more people driving around who are not that good at driving because you think they are. You also, of course, have many more people driving because more unequal countries are very bad at providing public transport systems. They do stupid things like declare they're going to have a car expressway between Oxford and Cambridge, which of course is going to fill up. The only good thing about it, if you remember the M11 protests and the Newbury bypass protests, is they decided to do this bypass, this expressway, in the area that should get the maximum number of road protesters. But equal countries have biking and cycling public transport. Richer countries are, in general, more equal. Greater equality is a feature of economic progress. It's extremely hard to become an affluent country without first gaining greater equality, and to carry on being affluent you have to be more equal, other than finding diamonds or oil you need greater equality to have economic progress. As yet, we cannot find an affluent country that has become too equal, which is really interesting. You cannot find in the richest 25 countries on the planet the most equitable one, illustrating some problem from having become too equal. So it's an interesting question about how equal do you want to be, but it isn't an interesting question for us, because we're the most unequal country in Europe, so we're a long way away from that. I'm going to mainly talk about Brexit and taking back control. The precursor to Brexit wasn't just inequality, it was an enormous economic slump. That graph there is showing you GDP change per capita away from 1950. You can barely see the 1970s, early 1980s, 1990s recessions, because the crash we had in 2008 wipes them all out. We had the longest, deepest, longer and deeper than 1929. And finally, when it began to recover slightly, the government goes and says stupid things like, we've got the fastest GDP growth in Europe. Not because they're trying to trick you, because they are stupid. That's my honest belief. I think they said it with such sincerity that they actually thought this was an impressive thing. I honestly believe that when George Osborne said that we were going to become the richest country on the planet by 2030, I think he actually believed it. Which tells you the problems of our education system, that we can produce people like George Osborne. I'm joking partly, I think it's very sad. I think if George had grown up in a different country, gone to a different kind of school, which they have different school systems in other countries, it would be a different university, a different college than the one that I live near. He would have had a more successful life. Europe, the downfall of George. You're going to have to better with this map because in a few slides time I'm going to show you another map showing some data upon it, but this is the continent we live in. The map is stretched by population because I'm addicted to doing maps like this. We're big, but we're not that big. There's Turkey. Remember all that stuff about how Turkey was going to join and you had to get out quick. But that's where we are. It uses a colour, rainbow colour scheme, so the more violent countries are the ones who were in first. We were a latecomer. We joined what was the European community at the time when we were most equal. And you could have argued against it then, on the grounds that, well, we were doing well. Only Sweden, the large European countries, was more equal than we were in the 1970s. So maybe we should have stayed out and kept our wage equality, but we didn't. We became very, very unequal. That has nothing to do with Europe, because many of these European countries are some of the most equitable countries in the world. So clearly the European Union doesn't make you more unequal. And we may or may not now be about to leave. We may not be able to afford to leave. I've learned a lot about Europe recently, which maybe I should have known about. I didn't really realise what the European Union did. I didn't realise that what it really does is regulate fridges. That's lots of very boring legislation. It tells you a few beaches are clean. And the reason I've realised this is that I've been invited to meetings in London recently to sit around tables and talk to civil servants about what do we do now for the Great Reform Bill. Apart from banging your head on the table, you end up saying, could we beg them to allow us to carry on using that, because we really don't want dirty beaches, but we can't afford to set up our own regulatory system. Because what the EU actually did was very boringly save us lots of money. But you're all going to discover this soon. And if you want a positive about Brexit, if we voted 52% remain, 48% leave, the Leavers wouldn't have gone away, Nigel Farage would still be in charge of UKIP as he's been forced to come back. And it would have gone on and on and on. As it is, we are now going to discover what being a member of the EU means and whether that was what was holding us back. I measure inequality by the take of the 1% or the take of the 10%. Not by the ratio, but I put the ratio up there just to be honest, because it's very easy to get a high inequality ratio if your poorest people in this case Greece, and Spain suddenly become a fraction more poorer due to massive austerity and economic collapse. But what I say with the most unequal in Europe is about 1% take about 14% of all income. No other countries, 1% does that in Europe. It's an enormous amount of money. If they took what they take in France, we could have another second national health service. That's when you're talking percentages of income, this is enormous amounts of money. Our 10% take 28% of all income. That includes people like me. We don't feel too greedy because 9 out of 10 of us are taking the same as what the 1% is taking, and we have to share that out amongst 9 times as many people. So we feel hard done by. So the university should pay me more. I can only barely afford to get a mortgage to get a house. Forgetting that most of you who are under 40 can't imagine being allowed to have a mortgage. That's the kind of sick country we live in, where we can't talk honestly to each other because we live such different lives. You see it on the BBC News, occasionally ITV every night, when a presenter discussing the newspapers tries to pretend that their children go to an average school and they understand people's problems. Most of the people you're watching on telly do not live lives like you, but they have learned. Take back control was apparently dreamed up by Matthew Elliott. It was a very, very effective phrase. And it is good to have control, democratic control of your country, and you do need to worry where the control went. We are going to discover that we weren't being run by Brussels. I'm sure somebody in the audience has an obsession with sovereignty. We can talk about that later. But the control had been taken away. But the control had been taken away by people at the top of society with a huge amount of money, who in effect had bought political parties. They bought New Labour. This is more obvious in the United States, where Democrats and Republicans do what their funders want them to do. One advantage of the Trump election, which I know there's been a lot of criticisms of anybody saying there's any advantage to the Trump election. I'm aware that hasn't caused itself anybody. At least, rather than having the billionaires paying bribes to politicians to do certain things, the billionaires are now actually in the West Wing directly. So it should become clear to the population who is pulling the strings, because they are there. Take back control was a very salient message, as was £350 million a week on the NHS. And we do spend less on the NHS than anywhere else in Europe, apart from Greece and Italy, for a few years in the very worst years per head. We would have to double our spending per head on health to spend what the Swiss spend and what they get because they live longer. I've just written a paper on France. The French 1%, as I say, takes so much less as in effect it funds or could fund a second NHS. They actually spend it on lots of things like decent state schools, decent unemployment benefit. They don't force all their young to take any job going. So Paris doesn't have the number of prostitutes that London has. That's what happens if you do welfare sanctions. And the French have about 27% more doctors. They have 130% more hospital beds. But the average length of time that somebody in France spends in a hospital bed is a day less than they spend in our hospital beds. Because people are not as ill as they are here, and they're stuck because we can't find anywhere to put them out of the hospital. And they live 3 years longer. The scary thing about take back control, the phrase take back control, and it's now easier to say this than it was a few months ago, because of what's happening in France, is that the phrase originally comes from 1930s Germany and from the Hitler Youth and from songs such as Tomorrow Belongs to Me. And that's the worry, that we are seeing a rise of that kind of nationalism, narrow-minded thinking and fascism that we had before. But before we got fascism in Germany, we had a rapid rise in income inequality in Germany. Income inequality is very, very dangerous. It makes otherwise good people behave badly. This is a complicated graph of political polarisation in the UK. It's the segregation index of Conservative voters since 1918. It looks remarkably similar to the inequality graph that taken the 1%. In 2015, it passed its previous high, which was 1918. 1918 was the last time that a third party got as many seats, in fact more, than the SNP got in the election. Sinn Féin got so many seats that Ireland went away. We are in very, very unusual times, with a peak of inequality, with a peak of political segregation and differences in our country. It is not good if your political party to have your vote segregated in certain areas of the country. The Conservative vote has been rising and rising in areas that already voted Conservative. It's a waste of votes for them. That's why they had to form a coalition in 2010, because they didn't have enough MPs. That's why they only have majorities at 12, I keep forgetting. Might be 10 tomorrow, by now. Depends whether people who are not Conservatives are clever enough to begin to realise it's got serious. And now it's got serious, you have to vote in a clever way. I might talk more about that later. I place lots of my faith in the people in Richmond. This is a map of the Conservative vote in the country. You can't see the key, but the purple is over 55% voting Conservative, the dark red is less than 10%. Incredible differences. Large swathes of our country have no Conservative voters, which used to happen, such as Liverpool. In other areas, I can walk out of my door and then go in any direction for 15 miles and walk into an area where almost everybody would have voted Conservative in rural Oxfordshire. Whereas Oxford East, where I live, looks like a dumb on the pit village when it comes to voting. It's incredibly different. This is Cotswolds. A friend of mine took this picture as a joke in 2015 of the same no campaign for leaving. But I'll show you a picture of the boat in a minute. It's a really interesting map if you draw these kind of maps, because it isn't like other maps. The Cotswolds narrowly voted to stay, very narrowly. But many areas near the Cotswolds in Wiltshire and Swindon in Gloucestershire, large parts of the South voted to leave. Because when you have high inequality, it is remarkably easy to be a loser. You can be better off than average, but still be losing. You can be better off in the South of England, but still see no way in which your children will be able to get a house with a mortgage. Because you've got to be much, much better off than that. A country with high and rising inequalities is a country that pulls apart and in which people's complaints about life can justly rise. They look up above them and see people much better off than them, getting even better off. And you look below and you don't look, because you can't go down there. Well, the middle class in this country have no idea how much you get on Job Seekers Allowance Day, because they couldn't imagine living on it. Whereas in a normal European country, you have a welfare state and benefits you can actually live off, at least for 2 years, that you could use. Your country collectively pays for your children to go to university. In Denmark, they'll even pay for a year for you to be an intern, because they're your children. These children. Not a set of economic units who have to maximise their own utility and human capital by taking out a loan that they'll repay by screwing somebody else for as much money as possible. I mean, how on earth we got into this way of thinking? To have the highest fees in the world. Here's the map. On the far side, it's showing you which group got the majority and the minority, and the most of it is blue because most of it is Remain. And here we've got it a bit more subtle. Areas are darker yellow if they're a strong Remain. So we're in the land of the converted. I've travelled from one area of 70% into London today, so I can travel through lots of other areas of 70% Remain, and then come up to you, the other Remainers. Why? Why exactly did you lot, and why did people in the middle of London, and why did people in Oxford, why are they so enthusiastic? Because they're not losers. Now, I don't mean losers in a derogatory sense. You've actually got a false sense of optimism. It's good to be optimistic. But Oxford, Cambridge and London are full of young people, more young people than that on average. Young people who've done well in life. Young people who have not yet failed and had to leave because they cannot afford the rent and live in these places. But this is going to happen to many of you. It has to. That's the only way we stay young. More people come every year, more young people. Fact is, they number have to go. Not quite, because you're quite good at building a few flats. We're not in Oxford. But at any one time, these are the places that have actually collected people who are on the winning streak. So life feels okay. Same in Manchester. The same, very interestingly, in Liverpool. Very young, lots of university students. But I also think there's a bit more going on in Liverpool. Not in Sheffield, where I lived for 10 years, but it's there in Aberystwyth. Most of the country, blue. It wasn't immigration, because the areas of the greatest immigration and the ones who voted most of them remained, and the immigrants were not allowed to vote. On the far east coast, there are a few areas which have had a rise in immigration recently, which are dark blue. They didn't matter for the result. Not enough people. Same as Middlesbrough didn't matter. What matters is the sway from Middle England, who when given the option of the same as before, or something which we clearly have not defined and will definitely be different, voted for different. I've seen this before. I've seen it when I used to teach in another university and we put our 12 module options open to our second year students and suddenly hadn't got their act together and so the 13th one was simply labelled to be announced. More of our undergraduates challenge than any of the 12 offerings of the exciting new geographies that we had to offer. Then that's what the basic vote is, something else. And in a way, it's what the top vote is. Something else, something different. Things are not good, which is why the economists found, when they searched through everything they could to find the best correlation to the rise of the Republican vote in Trump areas. What they found it was people living in counties, US counties, in which life expectancy and other health measures have got worse, in which you look around you and it's getting worse. Then you vote for something other than this, even for Donald. This is the European map of immigration, the latest data from 2014. If you remember the map I showed you earlier, you'll know what you're looking at. But there are high portions of immigrants in many areas all over Europe, in Paris, which is the big circle, because it contains many people, Switzerland, enormous levels, loads down in Spain. You should know some of them. They may be coming back soon. They're not very productive as they're elderly. They like to use a health service. And in the UK, it's Northern Ireland which voted for Remain and London. They're not swamped, not particularly high, certainly not problematic. One in three of the midwives in London are EU citizens but not UK citizens. It's not hard to work out why. The amount of money you're paid to be a midwife, you can barely survive in London, but it's an interesting place to be for a few years. So what are we going to do when people want to have babies in London in the next few years? I think midwives are the easiest example. It's easier to explain midwives than it is to explain people who pick hops or change the sheets in hotel rooms or keep Alton Towers running. Precursors to the vote in hindsight. In 2010, I've only got a couple of minutes, so don't worry, think of questions. In 2010, David Cameron announced his happiness index. You remember him doing that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, everyone can do that. Does anybody remember any announcement of what the result of the happiness index was? Why did they get away with this? They mentioned each year, 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014, I think the latest ones come out. It's a complicated index. For me, the key component is the question, which is an official statistic, on are you satisfied with your health? Because the most important thing in life is health. You learn about this as you get older. And that's the trend in the statistic in happiness index on health. It went off a cliff. 2010, 11, 12, 13, people were saying their health is getting dramatically worse. I haven't got the latest data, 14, on these graphs because I didn't release it in the same format, but I think it was the worst it had ever been. And it wasn't aging of the population. It was that people's health was getting worse. But the reason you know it was is that in 2012 and 2013, the life expectancy of elderly women actually fell. And then in 2015, we had the biggest drop in life expectancy, I think, still would be calculated. It was certainly the largest rise in death rates of any year since 1940. But you don't know about this because the figures were released as scheduled. They had been scheduled years before on the 23rd of June of this year. Now, if you ever wanted to release some data on a day, nobody knew about it. Because it wasn't just the 23rd of June, it was quite a busy day. And there was an embargo, so nothing could actually go to the press on that day. Every day, for weeks afterwards, something dramatic. What should we do? Don't believe politicians when they tell you it's the same everywhere and it's a global race and we're all very unequal. This is the amount of GDP that we tax and spend in the UK and how it's changed over time compared with many other countries in Europe. If you want good schools, if you want good hospitals, if you want good public health services, and it won't damage your economy in any way. Your workers end up more productive if they've got good health. That's why everybody in Germany can go home on Friday and still be more productive than we are if you look at their productivity rates. You want to do it well, but essentially you tax and spend publicly because it's more efficient, more economically efficient than spending privately. We've done a great service to the world. For the last 30 years, we've been running a natural experiment just to help prove this is the case. We've given more and more money to people themselves so they can choose how to spend it, and we've watched the educational statistics come down so that we have the lowest by age 24 in PISA, in numeracy literacy and problem solving in Europe. Yeah, we've really helped. You couldn't have noticed in the 1970s or early 80s. We in the United States had to become this unequal to show just what a stupid thing it was to do. And that I can accept. I can accept somebody might have had a theoretical argument in the 60s and 70s saying this was good, this will work. But having done it, when the evidence is staring in your face, it was a mistake, that's when it becomes unacceptable to carry on saying what a good idea this is. Ireland. It's a country beneath us because it became an economic basket case. Partly because it followed our advice to guarantee every bank account with no limit. And France, he's promising to sack 500,000 civil servants. She's promising to do even more. My hope in France is that the French are going to work out that they're not a failed state, that their education and health systems and productivity is better than ours, that their higher rate of unemployment simply shows that they haven't sanctioned 1 million people in 1 year, forcing them to take jobs that nobody would take unless they were forced to do that. There's a word for forcing people to work. My worry is that in all countries we tend to concentrate on what's bad about us, and the French will not realise how lucky they are. Yes, immigration has risen. This is a graph of immigration from 1841 to 2011. But it's risen all over the place. And we've had almost as many emigrants, apart from in recent years. For most of this period, of course, we sent out more people than we took in. We've created far more immigrants in the world than we've ever taken in immigrants. People have got more mobile. Everywhere, people are crossing borders more. It's a useful scapegoat. If things are getting worse, if your schools are not improving as fast as schools in other countries, If your health is not improving as much as in other countries, if your work is not as productive as workers in other countries, you blame it on the immigrants. Because you don't want to blame it on you and your friends. Ed Miliband, Nick Clegg, David Cameron, all members of the 1%. So for them, accepting that people want very high incomes, this is in all cases due to their spouses, just show that things have changed. It's very hard to accept that having a lot of money concentrating a few people is a problem, if that's your social group. We increased inequality by ourselves, we did it by ourselves. This was the effect of Osborne's last budget. Hammond's budget or autumn statement at least is more interesting, but isn't going to reduce inequality. There are reasons why we are in such a mess. Excuses. The rest of Europe didn't have an empire to lose. We never understood how well we give out our empire financially. We told ourselves we were brilliant, we were industrious, we created amazing machines and manufacturers and so on. But our economic decline coincided remarkably closely with the colonies gaining independence. So just maybe we made some money out of that empire. If you want reasons for why we made that decision in the 1970s and 80s to become more unequal. This is my last slide. This is what I suggest we should do. I'll go through it very quickly. If you want to take back control, if you want to feel that you have a sense of control, what you need to do is to tax at the normal European rate. Otherwise you can't have normal European services. It does not raise you money. It also has the brilliant effect of stopping greedy people being so greedy. What we fail to understand in this country, which people in the rest of Europe understand, is the reason you have a high income tax rate, say when you get more than £50,000 or £100,000, is to deter people asking for pay rises on those levels. It's not to raise more taxation. My favourite example is Jeremy Clarkson. Jeremy's getting on. But if somebody says to him, look, I'll pay you some more money, and if you fly to Australia and film for a week, you can have that cash, somebody like Jeremy will tend to do that. It's not good for you flying to Australia like that. I wouldn't stop Jeremy flying to Australia, but I think he needs a tax rate of 95% to 99% on his income over the first 2 or 3 million. So that if he wants to fly to Australia, he knows he's doing it because he really wants to. It's high tax rate saves the very best off from themselves. And then hopefully they will decide not to do that. Because you might say, oh, it's the market. Only Jeremy Clarkson can go and talk about cars in Australia. But I suspect there are more people who could do it just as well. I'm going to take too long, so let's go through it. You don't get good health and education systems unless you actually spend more of them. What you do get is the middle class abandoning them, or the upper middle class. The rest of Europe has hardly any private schools. The rest of Europe has laws to give rights to tenants. What point is the population under 40 going to work out that this might just about be in their interest? A basic income is a bit more idealistic, but we're seeing experiments of it coming in around the world, but of course not here. We penalise our young in special ways that nobody else does, and we didn't used to do before. As I said, 1 million people were sanctioned in 2013, most of those people were young. They were sanctioned for minor misdemeanours while claiming benefits, and the amount of sanctions that were levied against them was more than all the fines of all the magistrates' courts in England and Wales and all the sheriff's courts in Scotland that year. We've just created a new poor law overnight. So we're trying to starve poor people into work. And for the middle class, half of all girls in England are going to university. Loans, where the terms can be changed at the whim of the Secretary of State. You think it's 27,000, get an average of it's 56, you're paying back. get a slightly overambitious job, which is what graduates of this university like to do, and pay back £100. So at least we kind of equitably had a go at the young, except of course for the children of the 1%, because mum and dad just paid £9 up front. You don't tell people that their mum and dad have paid the £9 up front. In this university, I suspect it's at least 1 in 10 students will have their student loan, but they won't tell. I suspect only 1% will stay. Normal voting system. More equitable countries tend to have democratic voting systems rather than undemocratic voting systems. And you can read the last point, I don't have to say it. I'm optimistic. I don't think you can take things to this level, to a point where, and I've said this before, the graduates of Oxford and Cambridge University in the majority are likely to look at a difficult life for themselves and get away with it. You can do what Margaret Thatcher did, which was improve the living conditions of the best of 30% of society and manage to win majorities in 83-87. You cannot, you really can't, do policies which will only benefit the top 1% and hope to manage to keep control for that long. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much for thought-provoking, very interesting, excellent talks. I'm sure there's plenty of questions from the floor, and I'd like to open it up to you to ask these questions. Far away. I've got one. If you could introduce yourself so we know who we're talking to and things as well as you go, that'd be lovely. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Alistair. I'm a sort of freelance person. Trying to fight inequality. And I'm a big fan of both of you fellows and what you're doing, so this isn't a criticism, but your first slide, Kate, gave 4 quotes and described them as politicians, but actually 3 aren't politicians, and the one who is a politician has the luxury of not going to be re-elected. So I think there's a significance in that politicians can't say these kind of things, whereas the Pope and so on can. Why is that? Because of this last point here, that you know the newspapers and so on and so forth are very much now captured. So we have a feedback loop that's very difficult here, that as inequality gets higher, so the mechanisms to redress it get weaker, and the perceptions of too many people get see things through a prism that leaves them feeling, you know, the system justification theories of Joss himself. So it feels to me like it's very important to tackle these psychological factors behind the public perceptions of inequality. And I wonder if you have anything to say about how to go about that, because you know, there's a lot being said about how bad it is, but it's not getting through. How do we actually get through?
It's a really, really good question. I mean, but you said a politician can't say those things, and of course they can or could. And when they do, they're sometimes remarkably successful. Perhaps not as successful yet as we would like them to be, but if we think about the Bernie Sanders vote in the United States, particularly among young people, someone who could actually have the courage to declare himself a socialist in America. So politicians can say the unthinkable. If they're not frightened of the electorate and the media. And you're right, the media plays, you know, this huge role in constraining what politicians say. We need some charismatic leadership. You know, we need people who are willing to speak the truth about what's going on, talk about the evidence, I don't have a solution to how you fix that. I mean, I think that the media problem is an enormous one, but that may shift with time because younger people don't use traditional media. They use new kinds of media and use old media in new ways. And I think that can be really helpful because that helps to break down that control. I don't know. I mean, I think we need both that charismatic leadership and we need grassroots campaigning too. And what makes me feel optimistic, because I don't really feel pessimistic, but what makes me feel optimistic is looking at all the massive social changes that happened around things like the status of women, or gay rights, or civil rights in America. You know, big social movements, a huge change happening in fairly short periods of time, historically. Not because somebody at the top gave those things to people, but because there was a grassroots demand for it. But I'm not sure how to create that. I know there are people here tonight from the Cambridge Commons, at the front. Which is one of the groups, local groups affiliated with our Equality Trust. You know, so we do need this campaigning in local areas. Thinking of the fairness commissions that have happened in 15 or 16 cities. But your guess is as good as mine as to how we affect change.
Okay. There are two problems. One problem is that people on the left tend to be pessimistic. It's been called a melancholy before, you know, because partly because, of course, they don't tend to think that they're particularly great, because if you think people are pretty equal, who are you to be speaking to anybody and so on? Whereas on the right, you know, things are going to get better because I'm brilliant, I'm going to make them better. So we have a natural tendency to think it's all awful. The other problem is that we tend not to notice incremental change. We adapt to it within days. It's amazing how quickly we've got used to the idea that Donald Trump is going to be president. I suspect within weeks of London being bombed, people got used to bombs in London. And I think we adapt very, very quickly. And we completely fail to celebrate any achievement. So Theresa May actually saying that, the Chancellor getting rid of Help to Buy, which was money that went to very wealthy young people to buy very expensive flats in London. All the things that have happened recently, none of them are celebrated. If Marie Le Pen fails to win the election, as she probably will in April, will there be parties across Europe? Because there really ought to be parties the day after across Europe. But there's a terrible tendency not to notice things getting better. And the same happened in the 1920s and 30s. For almost all the 1920s and 30s, inequality rates dropped. But hardly anybody knew they'd dropped because they weren't measuring them at the time. People just said, this is awful, people are going hungry, mass unemployment. But the bosses started taking less, and people at the bottom began to get more. So we have a tendency to not know it. I can remember 2005, 2006 and 2007. When the news would show you bankers in the City of London doing brilliantly, buying at the peak a bottle of champagne for £30,000. We should have a diamond in it, but that was only worth £10,000. So paying £20,000 for the champagne. And it was these young men getting drunk, being celebrated. That's just gone. We don't do that anymore. There might be a little bit of that behaviour, but not as much. And we've sent the most greediest bankers back to America. We've always forgotten their names. There's one called Richie Rich. Anybody remember him? And his boss was paid even more. So head of the BBC is paid half as much now. But the problem is there's so much of a further way to go. It took from the 1920s to the 1970s to get us to be the second most equal country in Europe after Sweden. It could be 30 or 40 years with the most successful policies, barring an almighty economic crash. That's the fast route to equality. And it's not necessarily the best one.
So I've got one question just down the front here. Thank you.
Thank you. David Plank, the Cambridge Commons, and a background in local government and social care. I'm an angry old man because I've published recently, over the last couple of years, reports on social care in Cambridgeshire and nationally, which show the disgraceful state of our public services and how we treat our most vulnerable citizens in the most appalling manner. At this very moment, down this road, there are old people living in excrement. And people don't know about it. And I'm not just talking about the normal citizen, so to speak. When I went and talked to the Newnham Labour Party last year, people were shocked by what I had to say. And my last report was called The Silent Catastrophe, because this catastrophe is taking place behind the four walls. And that's why I'm angry, because producing reports is fine, it's a civilised thing to do, but it doesn't actually cut the ice. And therefore I do think we need to be more vigorous in the way we approach these issues. We need to use drama. But we know from I. Daniel Blake that is not going to cut a lot of ice either. But we do need to stand up and be counted and protest about what is going on in our communities to our most vulnerable citizens. Because we have now in England 400,000 people receiving less social care than 5 years ago, with the population in need going like that. And it's simply not good enough. And the Conservatives and Shire Hall allowed to get away with what I call the transformation balderdash, which is the national conversation about how we are transforming lives. 10% reablement. We were doing reablement back in Hounslow Social Services in the 1980s. This is nothing new. And it's a pretense. And it's an ignoring of people in desperate need. So that's why I'm an angry old man, and that's why I think we need to be less civilised and get more angry in order to produce action.
Yes, I do think we need to be angry, and I think it's probably going to become easier to be angry because we are going to see more rising mortality rates related to lack of social care and health care. If you think about the food insecurity that we're seeing at the moment, housing problems, etc. When I lived in the United States for 16 years, and the whole time I lived there, I have to confess that I used to feel a bit smug, because I used to think, I come from a country that doesn't have soup kitchens. Now, I have a student working with me doing her PhD on food insecurity in Bradford, and we are shocked at the prevalence of people who are going hungry in families. So we do need to be angry, we do need to stand up and be counted. And you're right, we do need art as well, and drama and stories, because when we produce social statistics, they only reach so far. Danny and I were talking earlier about, he's just put something up on TED website. And how many hits by morning?
100,000.
100,000 people had looked at it in the first day. Richard Wilkinson did a TED talk based on our book, and that's had over 2 million views. You know, whereas if we write a newspaper article, hardly anybody sees it. If we write an academic paper, nobody sees it. So we do have to find all of those different ways to reach, but we need the anger. Stay angry.
No, it's well being angry. I'll try not to be angry tonight, because I was here last week and I managed to lose my temper, so I felt slightly embarrassed. I was talking in the debate at the Cambridge Union about whether the government had failed young people, and I thought this was going to be fairly easy. And what I haven't banked for is the three young Conservatives opposite me actually arguing against this and believing what they were saying. And you're allowed 10 minutes, and after I got to 11 and still had reasons to fail to list, but I got angry because I felt sorry for them. Just that they honestly believed that this government was helping the young. And that's when I get most angry. And it's getting through that false consciousness of fairly posh people. So, Chanel, the over 85-year-olds who died in higher numbers, now think about it, they're over 85, they died all over the country. These are middle-class people. Working class didn't live to 85. So people dying in their own excrement are people who've actually had fairly comfortable lives, but in the end are going to suffer the most. The middle class take as much from the health services they pay in by tax because they live for 10 years longer than the working class. So I agree anger is useful and not being polite anymore is necessary. But it's if you can just get over to people that this will be your future. This is what's going to happen to you. If you're well off now, your children aren't going to care for you. And unless you're incredibly rich, you won't be able to pay for your own care. And even if you can pay for your own care, what do you think the person putting the catheter into you will think about you if you're that rich? Will it be a caring relationship that they'll have? Will they take pride in their job? You know, just think about your own old age. Just yourself, forget about society or your family. And it's not worth it for you to let the country carry on being this unequal. Because if you're unlucky enough to make it into your 80s or 90s, it's going to be bad for you. That's not a great moral argument, but it's reached such a point. I cannot find a group where I say this makes sense for.
I've got loads of questions now, haven't I? Sure. Well, I'll take two or three more. Yours was earlier, I think, so. Sorry, Louise, just there. Thank you.
So you have spoken about barely mentioning class, which I find interesting. Why don't you think about the relevance of class here, and whether you think that it's a categorisation which is useful for increasing group identity to increase anger for these issues and how hierarchical social economic status is? Or whether you think it's a way for people to make a value judgment on people within those categories. I'm doing various social sciences and generally interested in this.
The thing about class, and obviously class matters, and it matters more in some societies than it matters in others. But the reason, for instance, that we don't measure it is that if I told you that the UK had, I don't know, 20% more working class people than France, and more very aristocratic people, that would tell you nothing about the social distances between those groups in different societies. You might know there's more of one group than another, but you wouldn't know what the steepness of the social ladder was, how far apart the rungs are. And what income inequality is clearly measuring is that social hierarchy, is the steepness of the ladder and how far apart the rungs are spaced. So it's as if it's the scaffold upon which class is hanging, and by which class becomes extremely important, because it is through money that we express our status.
Yeah, short answer. I largely agree. It's very difficult to have different social classes when your income inequality is low. So in Japan, they largely disappeared. It's also very difficult to have different ethnicities when your income inequalities are very low, which is more complicated for to think about. But it's partly because people mix more, so you get more people of mixed ethnicity, but also once you don't have a group who is poor, all other issues begin to diminish. Fear of the other, fear of crime disappears. So there are many differences which are only sustained by income and wealth inequalities. It'll be interesting when several countries in the world see women and men paid equally, how the relationship between women and men will change in those countries. But it's our money is our fundamental way of saying what we think you're worth. And we are a mammal, and Kate Mitchell done far more on this than I done. We are...
I thought you were going to say, I wasn't a mammal.
we are attuned to recognise slights. You know, if I make out that, you know, you... I could do it, you know, we're attuned for embarrassment. I've become less embarrassed, don't worry, I won't do it too much to you. Your face changed, though, because you worried. We're deeply tuned to look for disapproval, because for most of our history, we grew up in small groups, and the most likely thing to kill us wasn't disease, because there weren't enough of us to spread diseases. The most likely way we would die is if we didn't have the approval of the group and they left us to fail on our own. So this, we hold it deep, and money is the way in which we tell you whether you're worth a lot or not. And too much money is highly disadvantaged. It goes to somebody's head. I mean, the benefit of Mr. Trump is we will watch, you know, on air somebody discussing how absolutely wonderful he is. And he believes he's wonderful, because if he didn't, how would he manage to get out of bed? You know, can you imagine Donald Trump wakes up one day and realises what's really going on? How would he manage to... He'd just hide under the covers, wouldn't he? And so it affects us. It makes us either feel terribly anxious and depressed and inadequate and worried, or it makes us feel terribly powerful and special. And if people don't understand us, it's because they're stupid.
Thank you. I'm actually just going to take one more question, I think, at this point, but I'll point out that we have got drinks outside, and I know Kate and Danny would be very happy to sort of take other questions, talk to people, and you're all very welcome to join us. So if I can just have one last one. Go on, at the front there.
Thank you very much for an insightful talk. My name is Rachel Perkins. I'm a first year Millwood's geographer. And I come from a school that converted into an academy, and obviously very recently the government's been very focused on converting state schools into academies. So what I would like to know is, why do you think the government is so interested in getting in privatising these schools, when they know it's very important to get as many young people involved in sort of high-level forms of work? Why do you think that schools are the first to be targeted in terms of privatisation, especially in this day and age?
That's a good question. I'm not sure they're first to be targeted. Everything's getting privatised, you know, so it's a sort of certainly not confined to education. But I think, you know, it's another of these examples where we've got a huge amount of evidence of what works and what's great, and yet we don't do it. The example around education that's always held up is what Finland did, you know, when they were worried that they were scoring badly on the tests of international educational attainment. They had a sort of national conversation. They decided all their schools were going to be state schools, teachers were going to be paid more, trained better, etc., etc. And they shot up the league tables, and they still are at the top, aren't they, for Europe. Sweden adopted free schools fairly recently, and the OECD last year published the strangest report I've ever seen them publish, which basically said Sweden stopped doing it. You know, you've caused a disaster. You need to reverse that policy. I had never seen anything like that come from the OECD.
The OECD are changing. They're producing reports around the world saying things are going badly wrong in countries that are becoming more unequal.
Yeah. But it's a good thing. And yet, despite all of that, why do we keep on...
They did it partly, and it began under New Labour, but only for the poorest school in an area, but... It's always dangerous doing something like introducing £1,000 a year tuition fees and not thinking carefully about it. They didn't like local education authorities. They didn't like schools cooperating with each other. What they wanted was competition. get schools to compete with each other for pupils, to compete for higher GCSEs, and that'll get higher and higher results, and then we'll become the richest country on the planet. You've got to remember, what was driving, at least our former Chancellor, was we're going to have the highest per capita GDP, we need the most productive workforce. What drove Mr. Gove was the idea that if you get A's and A stars, that means you're very clever, and so we must force the schools to compete to do that, and you know, eventually close down the ones that don't. They believe this stuff. The tragedy is that they're part of a product of a time when inequality was already rising in the 80s, and they voted for the person who was increasing it the most then as older teenagers and young adults. It's this idea that competition makes things better. Competition sometimes makes things better when you're an informed consumer and you've got lots of options to learn from your mistakes of buying something. Competition doesn't make things better when you only get one shot at something, like education, because you have no way of knowing whether, you know, you probably don't have made a very good choice coming here, but you'll never get to find out what would have happened if you'd gone to another university or done something else. So you're not and you cannot be an informed consumer. As it is, we're going to make you all fill in a student satisfaction survey to say how satisfied you are, when in fact you have no way of knowing how what's happened to you compared to other places. And if you all tick that you're really satisfied, your university will be allowed to charge future students more. So what's the National Union of Students said? At the moment, I think it said boycott it. I'm waiting for them to say, tick the very worst boxes. Only takes one or two students to do that, completely mucks up the student satisfaction survey. You take the free market economics out of university.
You heard it here first.
Right, thank you very much. Just a brief reminder that we have another lecture and we'll begin the new year with Professor Emilios Argoulias, who will speak on From Speculative to Sustainable Finance, Can Markets Do Good? And that's on Thursday the 19th of January. And thank both our speakers, Kate Pickett, Danny Dorling, for a fantastic evening. Thank you.